Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, the most popular movie talk radio show on the internet. Tonight, it's been wowing festival audiences for months, and it's been whispered as a frontrunner for the Oscars. From the upcoming drama, Grace is Gone, producers Celine Rattray and Galt Niederhofer. Plus, whether he's scoring an epic battle in Middle-earth or an intimate moment of suspense in this week's Eastern Promises, he's one of the most gifted and beloved talents in film today. The movie geeks welcome legendary film composer Howard Shore. And from last week's release of Great World of Sound, writer-director Craig Zobel. Dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Very special episode tonight, this Sunday evening. My name is Jamie, and we have Jerry here as well. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
We're up and running.
I know. It's
great. The Blog Talk Radio site recently underwent a redesign. We had a couple of glitches in our past show, but we're terrific tonight. God bless Blog Talk Radio. It's a great service, and we appreciate them so much. Just a couple of notes before we get started tonight. You can subscribe to our show through iTunes. It's absolutely free. The second we finish a program, it automatically downloads into your iTunes player. We actually have loyal listeners who listen to our show on their iPod as they're exercising. Did you know that, Jerry?
Yes, I did. I think that's incredible.
Maybe we should play like some aerobics music.
We should. I think we might want to change that intro.
That's true. And also, if you you can visit our archive page here on Blog Talk Radio, you'll find all of our great content in the archive section. We've interviewed people from Indiana Jones 4. We've had a Blair Witch Project reunion. We interviewed actor Joe Pantoliano last week about his new film Canvas, and two-hour tributes to Al Pacino and Brian De Palma and David Lynch and five of our great character actors. Just all of that great content is right there at your fingertips in the archive section as well. If you have a question for any of tonight's guests, you can give us a call at 718-508-9477, or if you're too shy to speak on the radio, you can always email us the questions at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. All right, you ready?
I am beyond ready.
Okay, let's get this thing started. In the new film, Grace is Gone, John Cusack gives a tour de force performance as a widowed father of two young daughters who must break the news to his children that their military mother has been killed in Iraq. The film has garnered sensational reviews from critics and audiences since its premiere at this year's Sundance Film Festival, where it took home the Audience and the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Awards. Joining us tonight are two of the film's producers, Celine Rattray and Galt Niederhofer. Under their company banner, Plum Pictures, these two remarkable creative talents have been behind some of the most daring and interesting films of recent years, including Steve Buscemi's Lonesome Jim, The Baxter, and the recent film Great World of Sound, which we'll be discussing later in the program with writer-director Craig Zobel. Their list of future projects includes a cinematic adaptation of Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, Diminished Capacity starring Matthew Broderick, Virginia Madsen, and Alan Alda, and Martin Scorsese's forthcoming picture, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome Celine Rattray and Galt Niederhofer to the program. Celine and Galt, are you both there?
We are. Hi, it's great to meet you, and thank you for the glowing introduction.
We do what we can. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Yes, thank you.
You're making us look much better than we are.
I want to ask you, let's start out with the basic question, which I'm sure you guys get asked most often. What is it that a producer does? Celine, do you want to take that one?
Sure. The producer basically is the person who pushes projects along, from sometimes an idea or sometimes a script form to the finished film in theaters. And basically you read scripts, and you choose a script you like, and then you find the director, you find the actors, you find the money, which is often very challenging, and then hire the crew and oversee, every aspect of the film getting made. And once the film is made, you find distribution for it and then work with distributors on the marketing and the release.
So you absolutely shepherd and kind of nurture the project from its very beginning origins to its end.
Exactly, and you know, you're really the person who along the way gets, you know, told no the whole time, and you really have to believe in
right.
something and keep pushing to make sure it happens.
Yeah, Gull, did you always set out to be a producer? How did you know that producing was something that you wanted to do, that you were right for? Galt? Do you know if Miss Niederhofer is with us tonight?
Well, I thought she was calling in, so I imagine she's about to join.
Well, let me ask you that question.
Yeah.
Sure.
How did you know that producing was right for you?
It's really, I've always loved movies, and I've always been someone who would go and see, you know, every movie that come out and was really passionate about it. And as I finished college and, you know, started my career, was really what I felt was, you know, the most exciting for me. And it took me a while to get that, but it's something I've been doing now for a little over 4 years, and I'm really, truly enjoying it. It's definitely a challenging job on a day-to-day, because you're the person who, you know, gets blamed for anything that goes wrong, and you're the person who has to, you know, really fight for things to happen. But I think it's something that it's you know, when it goes right, it's a really beautiful thing. When you see, you know, a crew of 100 people working together with the same goal, and when you see the finished film and it has the ability to make people, you know, laugh or cry, that's a very powerful thing, and you feel very proud that you were involved and helped make something happen.
And that's exactly what's happening here with Grace Is Gone. And, I mean, that must be so satisfying to see the reaction that this film has received from audiences.
It's been really, really thrilling. It's been so wonderful, you know, to see that, you know, what was, you know, a small film that we made, you know, for not a big budget, and you know, that we were fortunate enough to have a big movie star sign on and be a part of it. But that film's been playing at festivals and has had such tremendous reaction. Our first screening at Sundance, the lights came up, and you know, the whole audience was sobbing, and you know, the Puff Daddy who came to see the film was crying, which apparently was part of the reason why all the distributors wanted to buy it. And then it's played at all these festivals, and it just won Deauville last week in France, which was really thrilling. But it's wow. just been so wonderful to see how well received it is, and I think it's partly because it's a very topical film, because it deals with Iraq, but you know, in a subtle way, it's the reaction, you know, it's the impact of the war back home on one family.
Right.
And it's also partly been because of John Cusack's tremendous performance. But it's been really exciting to see the amount of press that it's gotten and how, you know, how the everyone seems very excited about it coming out.
Well, you talk about it being focused on the reaction to the war here at home, and we've discussed this with several filmmakers, asking them what they think of Hollywood's reaction to the war. I remember during the Vietnam era, it took a little while before Hollywood really came through with some portrayals of that conflict. And the basic consensus seems to be that these are the kinds of stories that we should be telling now. The reaction here at home, how it's affecting us, because the conflict itself is so evolving all the time. Yeah. Do you feel that way? Are you satisfied with Hollywood's reaction to this current conflict?
Well, I think it always takes a while for movies to, you know, it takes years for script to be made and then movies to be shot and then the movies to be released. So it seems like now is the beginning of a wave of films about Iraq, and there seems to be 5 or 6 that are coming out within the next year. The first of which was Rally of Allah that just came out.
Yeah.
And I think Grace Is Gone is probably the second, and then there's a bunch of others, including Stop Loss, Kimberly Pierce's film.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, definitely Hollywood feels that its themes and topics that are really current and important to make films about. I think, you know, in terms of our film and what it is, it's a film that really is about the impact of a war on one family, and it's really about loss, and the war is a backdrop for it, but it's I would say it's more about a movie. It's about the impact of the war at home on a family. So I think it's a pretty powerful film that people can identify with or will relate to, even if they don't know anyone who's at war, because it's about a family, and it's about a family that loses a parent, and it's about another parent having to step up and become the sole parent for two young girls.
Mm. Now, John Cusack, I've always adored John Cusack, and he's someone that I just every movie he's in I look out for because he's sensational. Was he a first choice? I know that he was looking for something that dealt with themes similar to these.
He was not only our first choice, but it was, you know, in the world of filmmaking where it takes such a long time to get anyone to do anything. Not only was he our first choice, but we made him an offer in December, and he signed on in January, and we started pre-production in February, and we were shooting in May. So it was a real record.
Wow.
It was basically less than 6 months from when we sent him the script for the first time to when we were, you know, shooting the film. It was really a fantastic, fantastic journey for us.
Wow, that really came together at a breakneck pace, it sounds like.
It really was. It was so quick. And it was exciting because he, you know, this is smaller than any movie he's ever done. It's a very, very different role for him.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, isn't the romantic lead or he isn't the big action lead, but he really got his hands dirty and he, you know, played this Midwestern, schlebby, you know, dad. And, you know, he was really willing to jump in and totally transform himself physically for the role in terms of, you know, how he looked in his wardrobe. And he would, you know, walk a certain way, and he really just and was hunched, hunched, you know, forward, and just was really went through a real big transformation, and is very believable as a Midwestern dad, which is, you know, obviously different
from
what
anything
he's
done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you that just shows his level of dedication and commitment to this material as well. And it was written and directed by James Strauss.
That's right.
Who also wrote Lonesome Jim, correct?
Correct. Yeah, he's really wonderful, talented filmmaker. Lonesome Jim was the first script that he wrote, and he did such a good job. And everything that he wrote, he also writes short stories, and all his writing has this, you know, very unique and wonderful tone. We see him as a young Alexander Payne. He's really just a sensation.
I would agree with that statement, definitely.
Yeah. Was there any question that he would direct his own script in this one?
You know, when this was the second script that he'd written, and initially, you know, he wasn't thinking that he would direct it, and we went out to a bunch of directors, and he had meetings with a bunch of directors, and he didn't feel that any of their vision completely matched up to his,
mm-hmm.
and his decision to direct, which, you know, which was a brave one for early on in his career, was because he felt that no one else was going to be able to make the movie that he had in mind. And, you know, when he first met with John Cusack, part of the meeting was, you know, John needed to be convinced that James could direct, and
mm-hmm.
which John was willing to take that leap of faith.
Mm. Now, the film was, after Sundance, it was purchased by the Weinstein Company, correct?
Yes, and it was really exciting because we screened the movie on a Saturday, and right after the screening, all the distributors stayed in the room for Q&A, which is rare because usually at Sundance they're running from
mm-hmm.
you know, screening to screening, and they were all there. All the heads of every studio were there. And then we went to dinner, and they all came and showed up and, you know, started bidding, and we stayed up all night. We started negotiating at 11 p.m., and we were up till 6 in the morning, and we were going from room to room with different distributors, and we were on the phone with the different distributors, and we ended up selling it at 6 in the morning to Harvey Weinstein, who was, you know, the most passionate and aggressive in his pursuit of the film.
Absolutely. And he's really, obviously, I mean, this is obvious, that he's been a huge player in putting indie films on the map. You know, but do you find it more and more difficult to get these smaller, more intimate films out there in the multiplex now?
I think it's a very, very challenging time for independent film. And if you look at the films that are coming out, you know, that are considered independent film, they have huge stars. For example, this weekend, a Brad Pitt movie opened on, I think it was about 10 screens across the country.
The Assassination of Jesse James.
Exactly, and that's being released as an indie with Brad Pitt in it. And if you look at the full schedule, there's all these films with huge stars that are being positioned as indies. And, you know, that raises an interesting question, which is where do real independent films fall into that? Where does the film that was made for $2 million that doesn't have, you know, Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt, where does that fall into?
Yeah, what does quantify an independent film?
Well, you know, I think the traditional definition of an independent film is a film that's made outside the studio system, mm-hmm. you know, with independent financing, which you know, Grace Is Gone would obviously fall into. But all the studios now have their specialty
release
labels.
Studios now.
Yeah, they have the specialty divisions now, yeah.
Exactly, and so those movies aren't really, you know, that they're not really indies. And then in the case of the assassination of Jesse James, that was actually financed by Warner Brothers, so it really is not an independent.
Hmm. Yeah, it's getting cloudier and cloudier.
Yeah.
Definitely, it's a very crowded, you know, marketplace, and you hear about movies that, you know, I haven't been doing this for this long, but you hear about movies in Sundance that would sell, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, that would sell in a very big way, and it's you know, if you look at Sundance, there are a handful of films that sell, but there's a lot of others that leave without distribution deals. So I do think it's a competitive time for independent films, and I think independent films need to have, you know, bigger and bigger stars, and, you know, they need marketing hooks, and it's hard for them to really break out.
Yeah. I want to talk about your company, Plum Pictures. When you look for a piece of material, what kind of criteria are you looking for out of it?
Well, we always look for great writing. So you look at something that you know, you think is beautifully written. You look at something that you think is intelligent. And then something, just because you have to be pragmatic about getting a movie made, something that you always look for is something that you think will be easy to cast. Mm-hmm. So you always look for great roles. In particular, you know, the financing is usually easier for young male stars. So you read material thinking, you know, what great roles would there be for, you know, Billy Crudup or Matthew Broderick or John Cusack, and then you also look for, you know, films that you feel you would be able to make at a price. You know, I think if it's contained in terms of amounts of locations or there aren't any cars piling up on a motorway, then you know there's a way to get those movies made in an easier way.
Yeah, and it must be exciting too to. Because Plum has been around since 2003. Is that when you started it?
That's right. Yeah, we've been around for 4 years.
Just the opportunity to build a body of work. What are you hoping that work says? How you hope it represents you and what it says about you and your company?
You know, I'm hoping that we'll, you know, over time get a reputation for good taste, and, you know, that people will like going to see our films. And I think, you know, you look at great producers like Scott Rudin or Killer Films or these companies where they've really got a reputation for great taste, and both filmmakers and actors want to work with them because of that reputation. And that's something that I think is very exciting as a producer, is to become a trusted place by filmmakers to get your movies made. I think one thing that we've done well is we've managed to get a lot of movies made, which isn't always easy. But, you know, this summer we made 3 movies, which was really, you know, tremendous for us. And we're, you know, I think we're very passionate when we find material that we like, and we will fight to the bitter end to get that made.
Mm. I want to ask you about two of these other films that you guys have a hand in. We're about to speak with Craig Zobel later on in the show. You guys came in kind of late on Great World of Sound. At what phase did you guys come in on that?
That's right. So Craig made this film for the most tiny budget, and he is so talented, and what he did was really, really amazing with such little resources. He had been shooting, and we'd seen some of the footage that he'd shot, and he did this, I'm sure he'll tell you more about it, but he did this really amazing thing where he created a studio, a music studio, with hidden cameras, and the cameras could pan all around the studio.
Right.
So people would be in that studio without knowing that they were being filmed. And we thought it was just fantastic, the footage that he'd shot. So we ended up coming in right at the end and raising the money for post-production, and then working with him to submit it to Sundance and then to sell it in Sundance to Magnolia, who just released it. But he's really, we're about to make his next film, which we'll be shooting right at the end of the year or the beginning of next year. And he's really a tremendous talent.
That's what he was saying, that you guys were handling his next film too. And he was praising you. We've been corresponding through email, and he was very very complimentary of Plum Pictures. And I've seen Great World of Sound, actually. I saw it earlier this year at the Sarasota Film Festival. And you're right. Those scenes with the hidden cameras, it's disarming because it's just its behavior. And those are some of the great highlights of that film, those scenes.
That's absolutely right. And I think it says so much about the desire to be famous in America today, and there's something so heartbreaking about these families who have absolutely no money, and
mm-hmm.
you know, yet their desire to make it is just so strong that they would be willing to sell their houses or you know have their kids not go to college in order to have that shot at fame. So it's actually, I think, a film that has a very deep and smart message underneath it, and it's really I think a very interesting reflection on our time.
Absolutely, it's a fantastic movie. I can't let you go without asking you about where you are with the rise of Theodore Roosevelt. This is an upcoming project that I believe Martin Scorsese is attached to direct.
Correct, and Leonardo DiCaprio. Well, that's a much, much bigger movie, obviously, than our usual little $2 million film. So that's something that will take us probably many, many years to make. But it's a really wonderful book by Edmund Morris, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book called The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, which is about the life of Teddy Roosevelt between the ages of 20 to 40. And it's really the making of a great man. It's every challenge that he had and how he chooses to overcome it rather than accept his fate.
Right.
And we optioned the book and attached a wonderful writer called Nicholas Meyer, who wrote The Human Stain and Fatal Attraction.
Oh, he's one of the best. He's you can't go wrong with him.
Very smart man. And we developed a pitch with him and then took it to, first of all, to Leonardo DiCaprio's producing partner, who loved it and basically took it to the next level. And then we pitched Leonardo himself, which was a very exhilarating hour of our lives. And then after pitching Leo, who said he was interested, Leo and his agents asked us to fly back to New York and pitch Martin Scorsese, who loved the project as well. So, I think it's going to take probably many years to make, but it's a wonderful project and it'll be a great movie when it happens.
We also have
another project which we're developing with Ron Howard, which is the remake of the film, the French film Cachet.
Exactly.
Oh, you guys are going to remake that. Wow.
Yeah.
And so both those projects, it's exactly when I talked about the speed of the John Cusack project, 5 months from getting the script to going into production, those two movies that are very, very big movies, it's probably exactly the opposite, that it'll take many, many years
right.
to get made.
So, Grace Is Gone opens wide on December 7th, is it?
Correct.
Okay, does it have a limited release prior to that, or is it just opening wide on the 7th?
So it's opening on December 7th, and so no screenings prior to that.
Okay, well, I cannot wait to see the
Likewise.
Film. It's number one on my list of most eagerly anticipated fall films, and we appreciate you being on our show so much.
Thank you very much.
It's such a pleasure, and thank you for being movie geeks.
always. We can't help that. Thank you so much.
Keep in touch.
All right.
Thank you. Bye bye now.
Thank you. Bye bye.
That is Celine Rattray. Her, she's the producer with Plum Pictures. Her new film is Grace Is Gone with John Cusack. An amazing film by all accounts, from everything that I've read, all the press, audience reaction. And if you can make Puff Daddy cry, really.
If you can make Puff Daddy cry, well, you've done your job.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time Puff Daddy cried in a movie? I'd be interested to know that.
When he's with J-Lo?
El Cantante, perhaps.
Maybe.
but amazing success story. And this film, it's so timely and it really tells a story that needs to be told, a universal human story coming off of this Iraq conflict. And
probably not just this Iraq conflict, probably just war in general.
Yeah.
I mean,
anyone that has lost a parent and the strain that puts on that single parent. I mean,
right.
It's you're right. It absolutely goes beyond being, you know, an Iraq inspired story.
But you're right. It's just something that needs to be told, though. It just definitely needs to be told.
Yeah. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And John Cusack, I mean, he is an actor that I've enjoyed every performance he's given, and he just gets better and better. And he
really can do anything. And he proved early on, I guess, with the Grifters we were talking a couple months ago. But he even proved with that was back in '91 that he could do like beyond the comedy, and he could do drama, mystery. I mean, he can do anything. I mean, he really can just do anything.
Yeah, and this film, he's very much a stretch for him.
Yeah.
Because he's playing, like she said, just a Midwesterner, a kind of schlubby kind of guy. And that's a big challenge to take on for someone that is seen as anything but that.
Right.
So he's a fantastic actor. Did you check out 1408? Did you get to see
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I saw that. And I thought, I mean, he's that movie. I mean, you go to that movie to watch him.
Yeah.
And he's phenomenal in that.
Well, speaking of films currently in release, we're about to speak with Howard Shore, and we couldn't be more thrilled.
No, I mean, you really couldn't
that.
Be. I mean, I can't be, but
I mean, this is a legend that we're about to welcome to the show. But you got a chance to see Eastern Promises.
Eastern Promises is excellent. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, it's David Cronenberg, you know, reunited with Viggo Mortensen, but more importantly, reunited with, you know, Howard Shore again. And it's just, you know, that relationship, like so many other director and composers, there's just magic to be had each
mm-hmm.
time out.
Yeah. And it really, 12 films, I believe, they've done together.
That sounds about right.
Starting with something like, I think, perhaps Videodrome.
That sounds about right.
Or James Woods actually called him the Bernard Herrmann of the synthesizer.
That's I believe it.
To get a compliment from James Woods, I mean that's
yeah, a compliment from James Woods, and he probably was, you know, having trouble with Sean Young at the time, so
yeah, to get him yeah.
It's
terrible. But this seems a little different for Cronenberg. I mean, Cronenberg has gone, on the surface it seems a little bit more mainstream than a regular.
I don't know if mainstream is the right word. I think he's come to terms with some things. I mean, it's really funny. People consider him like a horror director, and maybe in the early, like in the 70s, that was true. But I think he's trying to say so much more. He's a very fascinating figure. I mean, we couldn't do a two-hour tribute show to him. We would have to do a month-long tribute show to him because there's so much to be said about his films and about him. And I'm not even going to go into it right now, but his relationship with Howard Shore, though, is essential, and I think that comes to light really with Spider.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Spider is a turning point for, I think, both of them, and Spider is just a turning point, I think, for Howard Shore, because in 1 week, you have Spider, The Gangs in New York, and The Two Towers.
Mm.
That's quite a
workload.
Yeah, it's quite a workload. In 1 week, to go see those three films in the span of 5 days, I remember, and to hear those three different scores is remarkable.
Yeah,
incredible range.
He really does. And, you know, one of my favorite scores, just bar none, is The Fly.
Oh, The Fly's great.
And I remember just, obviously I love the film, and Chris feels the same way. It's one of his very favorites. But the score just elevates it just
mm-hmm.
to the stratosphere. A great score, and you know I collect soundtracks, so I have all the soundtracks from Howard Shore. I have the Cronenberg's Crash,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
is a very interesting score. But if you think about it, if you're watching Crash without music, without score, and someone goes to you and says, "All right, find the musical voice of this film," it's such a complex, it's a film you've never, you know, it's really not like anything you've ever seen before.
Right.
How do you do that?
I know, I mean.
But he finds it. I mean, it's perfect. And it's, I love that score. And obviously the Lord of the Rings scores are huge.
Very big. I mean,
some of the top-selling music composition for film as well.
It's just incredible, like the different director. I mean, he's worked for James Gray, David Fincher. I mean, everyone. I mean, he's just an incredible work. Pacino, I mean, he's just done incredible work.
That's right, Pacino. Thank you. I have to add that question. I can't believe I'm a Pacino maniac. And I mean,
he's just done, I mean, he is his own. He is definitely, I mean, with all the work that he's done, it's just amazing, and those scores stay with you. I mean, they're within, the scores exist outside the film.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
It's incredible.
Yeah, we are waiting to receive his call and bring him on to the show. And also later on the show, we have, as we've mentioned before, writer-director Craig Zobel, whose film Great World of Sound opened last weekend, and Entertainment Weekly gave it an A-, and it's just a... And you don't see those kind of raves very often in Entertainment Weekly.
No, you don't. You really don't see those kind of raves at all.
Yeah, and it is a great movie. It's very entertaining. Enjoyed it very much. And you know, that Sarasota Film Festival that I went to earlier this year, we're seeing more and more of those films now coming out. And, you know, it's a real pleasure to attend that and see these
films.
Well,
you guys get a lot of great... You've got more titles, bigger titles at your festival than we got at the D.C. Film Fest. We got a couple of the titles you got.
Right.
But nothing like you guys got.
Faye Grimm and such as that. Did you guys get that over there?
Which one?
Faye Grimm.
We got that. But, I mean... But, you know, that also came out on DVD a week later as part of that Magnolia Films 2929 Entertainment Release Strategy. But... For the most part, though, we did not get a lot of that great stuff that you guys got.
Yeah, it's a dynamite festival. We're going to have someone on from the Sarasota Film Festival, a representative on probably next month. It's one of the top, I'm not sure, 5 to 10 festivals in the U.S. It's really blossomed over a 10-year period, I believe. I believe this is their 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, no, it's...
And plus what film festivals do for the commerce of whatever host city it's in.
Well, I think they do a lot for you. It sounds like they do a lot for your area.
Yeah, yeah. What are you saying about my area?
I'm saying that you guys have better taste than D.C. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, well, I can accept that.
You just accept it, please, okay?
Our next guest is all up and ready to go, and we couldn't be more excited about this. Our next guest is one of the most talented and versatile composers working in film. This legendary talent began his career as the founder of the group Lighthouse before joining Saturday Night Live as their first musical director between 1975 and 1980. He soon fell into a collaboration with director David Cronenberg, a relationship that still thrives after 12 films together. His uniquely expressive and unforgettable work can be heard in films as diverse as The Fly, Ed Wood, Silence of the Lambs, The Departed, Mrs. Doubtfire, and, of course, Peter Jackson's epic Lord of the Rings trilogy, which is a remarkable work, breathtaking both in its scope and pure emotional power. His work is beloved by fans across the globe, and critics, groups, and awards organizations agree. His long list of honors include 11 ASCAP Awards, 2 Saturn Awards, 3 Golden Globes, 4 Grammys, a Career Achievement Award from the National Board of Review, and 3 Oscars for his work on the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And this amazingly talented musician doesn't slow down for a second. His new score for David Cronenberg's latest film, Eastern Promises, is in stores now. The Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra will be performing his Lord of the Rings symphony this coming weekend, and the complete recordings of his score for Return of the King will be released on November 6th. It is a tremendous honor to welcome to our show Mr. Howard Shore. Let me see if I can bring this line up. Mr. Shore, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Shore, thank you so much for joining us tonight and taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to start, when did you know that music would be your life?
I started studying quite young, when I was 8 and 9, and I was studying harmony and counterpoint, and started to play music with other musicians, and then I met other writers, and friends of mine who then became directors, and some became actors, And that group as a kid, you know, in the teens, was really important to me because some of those friendships were very long-lasting, and I did a little directing, I did some acting, and then I just decided around 17 to pursue music, and music was the thing I was really interested in.
So you started bands, you started Lighthouse in the 70s?
I started bands when I was 14, right?
Mm.
13, 14. Lighthouse started, I think, about 1969. And I was one of the founding members of that group, and I toured with the group for 4 years. I did, I think, about 1,000 one-nighters between 69 and 72, and I was quite young, so I got to see a lot of the world, and we toured with Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Big Brother and the Holding Company. It was an interesting period.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
So how did the job at Saturday Night Live come about for you?
Well, Lorne is a few years older than I am, but we met at a summer camp in northern Ontario when we were kids. I was 13 when I met Lorne, and we became good friends. And when we started writing together, and we did a show actually in northern Ontario in summer camp at a camp called Timberlane that was like a sketch comedy show. It was the early genesis of Saturday Night Live. This is now about 1960, 61, and we do it a show once a week at this co-ed camp on Saturday night, and that was really the start of our collaboration. And then we met Danny Aykroyd and Gilda Radner in Toronto and Second City people, and Lorne went to California. I went on the road. He was working with Lily Tomlin and Flip Wilson, and we met in New York, back in New York at 1975, again with a group of friends, and started the show. There was probably about maybe 15 of us, 12 or 15 writers, performers, musicians, directors, that kind of thing.
Just an amazing, just a breathtaking assemble of just tremendous talents that converge for Saturday Night Live at the beginning.
It was an interesting time. I mean, people came from California, from Chicago, mostly from Second City. Belushi was from Chicago, and then Bill Murray came from Chicago. Gilda from Detroit. Danny Aykroyd was in Toronto. So, you know, so a group of us came. We came from all over. Some people were in New York. Ann Beats, Michael O'Donoghue in New York. Cheryl Hardwick was in New York.
You were also instrumental in the formation of the Blues Brothers. Is that correct?
Well, the Blues Brothers were, it was an opening act for the show. As when we did the warm-up on Saturday night for the dress rehearsal and for the live audience, we do a warm-up with the band. And it was very open, it was very free, and we'd do improvisations, and we'd play a lot of blues stuff and R&B stuff, stuff that I love from that period, from the Stax catalog, and I was writing R&B tunes and writing the theme to the show, which was very Junior Walker inspired, and so the blues was part of the creation of the show. I mean, it was what we were interested in, and so Danny would join in and play a little harp with us in the beginning, you know, just warming up. It was a very loose kind of thing, and then John wanted to join in and be part of it, and I would introduce them as those brothers in blues. The Blues Brothers, I don't know where it came from, but I would just introduce them as that, and then that sort of stuck, and it kind of went on from there.
What kind of tools did you take away from your SNL experience?
Well, it was a good collaborative period. It was a great way to work with writers very, very carefully, very closely. It was a good way to work with performers. You got to work with different directors. The hosts were there every week, a variety of hosts, really interesting, fascinating people from all areas of, you know, of the world. There were writers, performers. So, I mean, you learned a lot. I mean, I was in my 20s. It was a way to really do repertory theater for television. It was like, you know, a group activity that expressed itself in a weekly show. You know, Saturday at 11:30 was a culmination of our work that week.
Yeah.
And the early years of the show, there really was no form to it. Now, when you watch Saturday Night Live, you know what it is, and you know when update comes, and you know it has this structure to it. But in the beginning, it was very free form, and you could, if you watch those early shows, it was us just trying to come up with enough ideas in music and comedy, you know, to really to do 90 minutes of good television a week.
Yeah. It's a tremendous challenge, I'm sure. During this time, did David Cronenberg approach you? How did that relationship begin?
No, as I mentioned earlier, I've been writing and, you know, I've been studying music since I was a kid and writing, and really didn't have the means to realize the things that I was hearing in my mind. I was only able to work with, you know, small groups, chamber groups, brass trios, you know, whatever I could get together to write for. And writing for the band on the show was okay, you know, for the period. It was exciting for a year or two, but it was limited in a way to what I was wanting to do with music and the things that I was imagining. So I thought movies were very experimental to me, because I came of age kind of in the 50s and the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So movies always, you know, film music to me was a way to really try really kind of different things. It was a way to experiment and do things. And so I kind of looked to that. And around 78, I did a film in Canada, a thriller. It's actually a murder mystery film with Elka Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then David knew about that. And then I think when he was doing The Brood in 1978, I think it was around the same period, I asked him, I approached him if he was interested in having an original score for his films, because he had always did his films with needle drop, didn't have the budget to hire a composer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cronenberg, David's been making movies since he was 16, 8mm movies. And then 16 millimeter, and then 35. So, around the time of The Brood, 78, he felt he was maybe ready to try it. And he knew me. I was younger than David, and he's a few years older than I am. I think about 3 or 4 years older. So when you're kids, I mean, when I was 12, David was 16, and you'd see him in the neighborhood, and he had this beautiful Italian motorcycle, and he had great clothes, and he had a page boy haircut from the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
And he just looked amazing. And you would see him around the neighborhood, and you didn't know who he was. And when you were 12, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
Sight, you know. And so, and then I found out that he made films, and I would see his films in underground film festivals, which were popular in the 60s. And you'd go at midnight, and you'd see, you know, films till like 2, 3 in the morning at these underground festivals. And most, a lot of short films, 30-minute films, one reeler type things. And I saw some of his short films, and so I became interested in what he was doing. And around, and then again around the time of The Brood, 78, I approached him to see if he was interested in work collaboration. And he said yes, he was, and so we started working together.
And talk about a collaboration that's just endured and thrived so well throughout the years. Tell me about that working relationship. What makes the two of you gel so well together?
I think just, you know, that we're from a very similar background. We both grew up in Toronto and a similar neighborhood. A lot of our friends now are people that we knew when we were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And David says I introduced him to his wife, Carolyn, that he's been married to for a long time. I don't know how long, but quite a long time. So I think there's just this like sensibility, you know, in the way we look at things, the way we look at films, the way David is the most well-read person I know. And I think his age, maybe that fact that he's a few years older than me, always seems like a bit of an older brother. And I was sort of looking up to him because he always knew much more than I did. And I was always learning things from him all the time. And I still feel that way. I still feel that every time he takes on a new project, there's a learning curve because you're catching up to Cronenberg. Never really, you know, you don't really know enough. I mean, you know, Eastern Promises is interesting because he did a, you know, like a celebrity list in Amazon of books that he had studied for the film, and he listed the top 10 books that were all about, you know, Russian politics, Russian philosophy, Russian criminal activity. I mean, amazing books. And I thought, you know, it's so incredible. I mean, he's interested in so many things, and he's so well-read, and so it's a constant learning. And I think that's an inspiring thing because the group has stayed together for a long time, almost 30 years, making these films.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always constantly growing, and, you know, we're learning new things, and we're expressing new ideas. And also, when you have a group like that that works together, there's no way to go back. You're constantly going forward because
yeah.
you've done all this work. And so you can't revert to something you've done. Nobody gets away with anything, you see, because everybody knows everything about everybody.
Yeah, it's like a family.
Yeah, so you've got to constantly be on your toes and be doing your best work.
So let's talk about Eastern Promises for a little bit. I'm interested in the process of crafting a musical voice for these films.
Mm-hmm.
So taking Eastern Promises, what did you have to understand about the themes of the film, or what were your considerations before you started to craft that theme?
Well, David always sends me either the books that he's interested in or books that he's adapting very early on. I mean, he sends these scripts to me really early when he's just starting to think about it, and even before he's cast the film. So you start clicking away on things that he's thinking about. I mean, Eastern Promises, it involved a lot of research of Russian folk music. We listened to a lot of music together. You know, we would do the research in the libraries, and then we would pass the music back and forth to each other. So we were constantly listening to a lot of music, and he was listening to a lot of music when he was shooting. And I always go to visit him when he's shooting. I always go to the set. I meet the actors. Of course, I know Viggo from Lord of the Rings and from History of Violence. And so it's great to see him. And, you know, and also Peter Shusitsky, the great cinematographer who shot Dead Ringers and all the movies in between, is incredible. And so Ron Sanders is there during the shoot, who has been editing David's films for years, a fantastic editor. And so, you're going and being part of this group, Carol Spear, the production designer, and you're soaking up atmosphere from the set, from the script, from David. Watching David shoot is a really interesting experience, and really, it's really thought-provoking when you watch how he shoots and the things that he selects and where he moves the camera and where he puts the camera. It's really interesting. And so all of those things, I think you go away from that with ideas and you start to assemble a body of work just based on the idea of the film. We also looked at Russian criminal tattoos. There's a wonderful documentary Alex Lambert did. Went into a high-security Russian prison and shot criminals with shot their tattoos, basically. And it's a documentary on what the tattoos mean, the hierarchy of the criminals in prison, and how all of their history is expressed on their body. You can tell in prison just by looking at a man's tattoos what he's done, how many murders he's done, how many felonies, how many robberies. Tells you everything about him. And there's actually a scene in Eastern Promises just before the steam bath where they're coming down the hall, and he says they like to have the meetings in the steam room because you get to see what a man looks. You can see his tattoos.
Right,
right, right.
You can know who you're dealing with.
Yeah, yeah. I remember reading an interview recently with Viggo Mortensen where he discussed how important those tattoos were.
Yes.
It even took 4 hours a day in makeup to put those on, but it was very important for his character.
Yeah. So we passed the documentary around. We looked at books of tattoos, tattoo art from the period. And then through the folk music, listening to the folk music, I started writing and, you know, thematic ideas all away from the film, just thinking about the film. And then I create, you know, a series of pieces mm-hmm. based on the impressions of the film. And then there's a scoring process later on that actually is taking this music and scoring it, if you will, you know,
right.
to the film, you know, deciding where things go and how they go and how they're orchestrated. And, you know, it's a very linear process doing film music. It's a step, you know, it doesn't all happen at once. It's, you know, there's composition, orchestration, and then recording, which is performance, really, when
mm-hmm.
you're in the studio with the actual musicians, which is a whole part of the process in itself, and then the post process of editing and, you know, actually producing the,
and Cronenberg is a hands-on, has hands-on involvement. He's there with you every step of the way in the studio, or
he is in a kind of mental, intuitive way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll talk on the phone a lot if we're not physically in the same place, but it's a constant dialogue, really.
Yeah,
and until we discover, you know, the truth of the story, discover the truth of it musically. I mean, sometimes it's difficult. It's not always easy working with people that you've worked, you know, as I say, because it's this constantly changing landscape. I remember when we were doing Spider, it was difficult to find the, you know, the idea, the music sense of Spider, because Spider didn't speak, you know, it was such an interior world, and music is a very interior world. It's a very emotional, interior, practice, really, music. So to find for Spider was difficult. I mean, it took a while to find that, and I think all of these films do. They all have their, you know, their discovery, and their, you know, it takes a lot of work just to find the essence and the truth of the film.
Yeah, and that's what I love about Cronenberg's work is, you know, so many movies out there are carbon copies of another movie you've seen, but David Cronenberg's films, you've never seen those before. So I was discussing with Jerry, my co-host earlier in the show, you take a movie like Crash, you're seeing the movie Crash without a score, you're needing to come up with a musical voice for that film, and it's unlike anything you've ever seen
yeah.
before. I cannot imagine how daunting that must be.
It is, and what you do, and I talked about this in Lord of the Rings, because we talked about daunting. You said it's a daunting, and I started on that project, and you felt like Frodo. You felt like this little hobbit. You know, you had this one, and you had to take this object to Mordor, so a place you didn't know how to get there, where it was, how difficult it was going to be. And you just proceed, you know, with will power
mm-hmm.
and determination,
right?
And you know, discipline to do it. And you just proceed, and you just kind of go step by step. And you can't go from A to Z immediately. You have to go through the steps day by day. You know, it's kind of ritualistic in a way. And you just proceed in increments, and then suddenly you look behind you. And you have ideas and thoughts, and, you know, you're starting to create the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there's 5 minutes of music, and then there's 10, and then there's 30. You know, you add to it. It's a very additive kind of mental discipline, really, composition.
Well, talking about building it a little at a time, you have the complete recordings for all three films. I believe The Return of the King is released on November 6th.
Yes, we're just finishing it, yes.
And it's something like 11 plus hours of music total, isn't it?
I think it's close. Well, it's 10 CDs in total are part of the complete recordings. Three for Fellowship, Three Two Towers, and four for Return of the King. And it's as complete, you know, as I can do right now. I mean, without any outtakes or rarities
right.
or anything.
Right.
I mean, there's actually more music, but, I mean, some of it wasn't used in the film. I mean, what I put on the complete recordings is everything that was used in the films. There's four CDs of music in Return of the King extended version. the long version.
Wow.
Oh, what a staggering accomplishment.
And so it's all been remastered, it's been edited into tracks. Doug Adams' liner notes are fantastic. You know, there's 50 pages of liner notes for each edition. And then Doug is working on a standalone book next year for all of the music.
Mm.
For the trilogy, and we've been working on it. The releases took 3 years, one year for each edition. So really, the work on Lord of the Rings, I started in 2000. It's now 7 years.
Mm.
Well,
that's
yeah.
a journey, right
yeah.
there. Tell me about the symphony performances for your Lord of the Rings score that have been taking place.
The symphony is it's a six-movement piece for symphony orchestra, for mixed choir, adult choir, children's choir, soloists, and there's some folk instruments as well in it. It's the total instrumentation is 225 on stage, and it's a 2-hour and 10-minute piece. A narrative work that takes you through the world of Middle Earth, through Lord of the Rings, in that amount of time. Really, it's not everything that was created, but it's really what was able to be played in a concert performance in one sitting.
Oh.
And it's had. I think about 140 performances all over the world, in the Far East and in Europe and Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Canada. And I've done many performances. I did a lot in 2004. This year I did one at the Blossom Festival with the Cleveland Orchestra, which is a great, amazing orchestra that I love. And that's the second time I performed with them of the symphony. And now I'm getting ready for a performance in Paris at the Châtelet Theater in November 2nd and 3rd.
Oh.
And there's other conductors that play the work. So, you know, the symphony was really a way to give the work life. So it just didn't have these recordings, or it just didn't exist in the film.
Right.
It now can be played, and with real orchestras playing it, and and singers and children's choir, and it's a very community type event. I mean, you mentioned the Cincinnati orchestra is playing it this coming weekend, mm-hmm. and if you're in Cincinnati this week, you'll see like the choirs are rehearsing for it, the children are learning Tolkien's music, all in Cincinnati. All that comes is a conductor to do it, and it's all done with the Cincinnati community. And so it's really a wonderful kind of music making event, and it's great for in the community, and it really seems to have a great community type of feeling to it.
How satisfying must that be, that on a global level that your score is means so much to so many people. It's moving people so much.
Mm.
That's just an amazing, amazing accomplishment, The Lord of the Rings. We actually have an email question for you,
okay.
And it's concerning one of my all-time favorite scores, which is from The Fly.
Yes.
It's a very heightened and operatic score, so it makes sense that you're in the process of basing an opera around that concept. How is that shaping up?
The opera is finished compositionally. Piano vocal score was finished in the spring, and I'm orchestrating the piece now, and I'm going to Paris. The premiere is in Paris at the Châtelet in June 30th, this coming year, 2008, and it's a co-commission between Châtelet and Los Angeles Opera. It goes to Los Angeles in September.
Hmm.
And The Fly was something that I had thought about for many years. I thought it was a good opera subject. I became interested in opera in the early 80s, and I started thinking of film music in that way. I learned a lot about writing film music from studying opera, but I stayed away from it for a long time until I felt I was ready. And then after writing this much music for Lord of the Rings, which is essentially an opera work. It uses Tolkien's languages. His five languages are used in the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And the music for the film is essentially, it's based around voices, choral music, and soloists. And we use, there's many singers that I wrote for in the course of that 10 or 11 hours of music. And so having done that, I felt, maybe I was ready for the opera, and I wanted to work with something that I was comfortable with, that I knew, and so I always thought The Fly was a good subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Placido, and I told him about it. He became interested in it, and he commissioned it for LA, and so I've been working on it for 2 years, and this is my last year now of orchestration and the rehearsals. I'm doing a workshop with David Cronenberg in Paris next week.
So he is, Mr. Cronenberg is involved?
Yes, in directing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes,
great,
yes.
Great.
Dante Ferretti did the production design, the great designer.
Incredible.
David Henry Wong wrote a wonderful libretto, incredible libretto, and it's cast now, and for me, it's just such a wonderful thing to work on. I mean, I love it. I love the form so much.
Yeah.
And it's just a great, great gift for me as a composer to work on it.
Well, I can't let you go without asking about two of my favorite talents that you've worked with, and one is Martin Scorsese. For the past few years, fairly regularly, you've with The Aviator and The Departed and some of his future projects, you've collaborated with him. It seems like if there is any director out there that is a musical director, he is definitely one.
Yes.
What's that like, that collaboration like?
Well, Marty loves music, as we know, and that's always been a great bond between us because we both love it so much.
Right.
So, and we're constantly passing ideas back and forth to each other. So that's really been a great part of the working together. And I met Marty and Selma Schoonmaker in the Brill Building in 1986.
Wow.
And I did a film with them called After Hours.
Yes.
And then I've worked with them on five productions now, I think. And they're just incredible to work with, Marty and Selma. And they're just great filmmakers. They're brilliant people to work with. They're funny and creative, and they challenge you, and you grow, and we try things, and it's just a very fluid, wonderful relationship and collaboration. And you see that in the films, I think. And Marty's like that with everybody who's working with in films, because there's so much love for the art of making films, and we all, you know, appreciate that. And so it's a nice place to work when you're working with Marty.
Oh, I bet it is. And his next project is the Rolling Stones concert film, The Shine a Light.
Yes.
What a perfect
He's such a great documentary filmmaker. I mean, the Dylan documentary was just breathtaking.
Oh, I love that documentary.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
I also have to ask about the last person I need to ask you about, because I'm kind of a super geeky fan of this man's work, and that's Al Pacino. You worked with him
that's
on Looking for Richard.
Yes.
That was a big passion project of his. What was that? What was that experience like?
Well, it was actually a wonderful project, because I love working with writers, and you know, I've done other literary adaptions besides Tolkien, G.G. Ballard's Crash, William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, and now Shakespeare. How wonderful to work with Shakespeare. And that just opened up, you know, a lot of creative ideas. The text for the score that I wrote is a Latin text. It was written by Elizabeth Cotnoir for the film. And I worked with a choir. It was recorded in a church. Al came. It was just it's just such a lovely thing when the director and the composer are interested in the same word, the writer.
Yeah.
You know, because you're really going back to the source. Like, both of us are looking at Richard and, you know, and really expressing ideas about Richard. And that's, you know, Looking for Richard is about Al Pacino's, you know, search for the truth in Richard III, and as the composer, you're doing the same thing. So you're really on the same wavelength, the same journey, and you know, and I think the work was good on that, very good.
It was, fantastic. In any stories I can get about Pacino, I grab them wherever I can.
Yeah.
Mr. Shore, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yes, really, thank you.
You are more than welcome to join us anytime in the future. Just say the word. But thank
you
so much.
Yeah, I look forward to that. That'd be good.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye then. Bye.
That is Howard Shore. I can't believe we just spoke with Howard Shore.
Yeah, I'm in a state of disbelief, to be very honest with you.
Yes, and he spent a lot of time with us. And,
yes, he did.
I still had 10 more questions. But
I'm eternally grateful that he spent all this time with us.
I know. What a wonderful talent.
Yeah.
Howard Shore. His new score for Eastern Promises is in stores now. It's also playing at the theater, by the way. And you can also purchase his complete recordings of the Return of the King score when it's released in record stores November 6th. Do they still say record stores?
I don't think so, but believe it or not, it's a very hard habit to break saying that. You're so used to saying that.
I know. I guess I'm showing my age.
I know. There are people listening. What's a record?
Yeah, what is that? All right. Our last guest for the evening is up and ready to go, and we're very excited to speak with this gentleman. Last weekend, a little film called Great World of Sound opened in limited release and set that great world of film critics and theater audiences buzzing. Entertainment Weekly graded this humorous and often touching take on the perils of the dream factory that is the music business an A-, stating that the picture has some of the lovely desperation of a Glengarry Glen Ross and a disarming sweetness. This is high praise indeed for first-time feature writer-director Craig Zobel, who has already built an impressive career behind the scenes, including credits as co-producer on the remarkable film George Washington, and as the production manager on the films All the Real Girls and Undertow, for which he also served as assistant director.
All great films.
Yeah, fantastic films. It is a real treat for us to welcome Mr. Craig Zobel to our broadcast. Craig, are you there?
Yeah, hi guys. How you doing?
Welcome to the show.
It's about time we get to speak. It's been a battle this past week. we're finally here. I saw Great World of Sound earlier this year at the Sarasota Film Festival, and just a fantastic film, sensational work, and I can't wait to speak to you about that. But first of all, tell me a little bit about how you got started in the business.
I went to film school in North Carolina. It's a small conservatory art school called the North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. I was the third graduating class of the film program. It was a new program at the time, and I met a bunch of fun people, and we all just sort of started, you know, trying to make movies. David Green, who you just mentioned, was like, he was the class above me and had been kind of like toiling out, had graduated the year before and had been kind of out in the world, like in LA, and decided that he was going to come back to North Carolina and shoot George Washington sort of right when we were like graduating, and you know, it was at the point where we were all kind of like, I think if you rent a camera, you have to have insurance of some sort. You know, like, kind of like learn how to like actually make a movie, not just in film school style. But yeah, so that's kind of where I started. But
and David Gordon Green is such a dynamic director. Can you tell me some things about him that make him such a special talent?
Gosh, I mean, he's just he's an incredibly creative dude. I'm trying to think of like what a very specific thing would be that makes him like special. You know, he's like very collaborative, very much, but at the same time, very like has a very vivid kind of like idea of what he wants at all times, which is like super super cool. And, like he knows what he wants and is able to at the same time like seek as much sort of outside comment on it from the actors and, you know, the crew members and like the people helping him make the film and let like new ideas come in but still control those and sort of shape the movie, and I think he's just really good at it.
Yeah. Were there things that you took from from your work as a production manager on some of these projects that were helpful to you as you ventured into feature film directing?
On a very practical side, being a production manager doesn't sound cool at all. It's basically you're the person who's like spending the money on the movie. You're like hiring the caterer and like renting the equipment and doing stuff like that. But in learning how to do that, especially on a low budget movie, like you start realizing like what a bad use of money versus a good use of money is, and like when like it's worth it to spend money because that shows up on screen and makes the movie more kind of dynamic, and when like you just wasted some money, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
In a very practical way, I know that doesn't sound that cool, but it's like I got very interested, and that's kind of why I started pursuing that. Was I was just sort of like, it occurred to me, after I graduated from school and had worked on some projects that were sort of rough, that I was like, you know what, like, it is a big, there is a big creative aspect to like, the nuts and bolts of producing something, you know, so I feel like I learned a lot from doing that, and then you get to just, like, be in on all of the conversations and watch, like, all of the, like, different people's, it's a cool job because it's also, you touch all of the different departments, you understand why the, like, makeup person is so passionate about like why he or she needs their thing to be going this way, and at the same time, at the same moment, why the camera, you know, that first AC is like freaking out over like some other thing. You know what I mean? Like you kind of like touch all the departments, which I think was like very educational.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, and plus you need every tool in your arsenal when you're an independent filmmaker, because it's an uphill battle, and you have to. You have to pinch every single dollar and treat it wisely, I was saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like, I think that's, like, that's kind of, like, what, anybody who actually, like, pulls off, like, making a movie, like, completely just, like, knows that without, like, having to mention it. You know what I mean? It's just, like, yeah. Like, you're just, like, yeah.
I hear you on that.
So Great World of Sound, it's fantastic, and one of the things I liked about it was it's very universal, but it's a world, it's a very specific world that I had not really seen portrayed before in films, particularly in this way. What inspired this idea?
Well, first, thanks. That's nice of you to say. I take that as a compliment. I think it inspired me, I guess, the sort of the initial way that I found out about what the film is about. The film is about it's about a talent scout scam that happens in the music business, where people like put ads in the backs of newspapers saying like, you know, record company is coming to town one weekend only. Do you have what it takes to be a star? Type thing, and then these like people come in and sign like, you know. Like, basically, people are looking for, like, undiscovered talent, and, you know, to bring them to the world. So I found out about kind of that whole world of stuff initially through my dad, who was he was a DJ, actually, in the late 1970s. And through his work as a DJ, he kind of came across this job to be an A&R man for a little indie record company, and took it. So like the initial idea, you know, and then like as my dad went through the thing, he started kind of putting two and two together, thinking that at first he was like helping people out, but then like later on, kind of like starting to realize, you know what? Wait, this isn't sort of clicking right. You know, what I'm doing here, it seems like I might be ripping people off. And then he kind of started doing some investigation and realized that he was kind of part of a scam, which I just thought was interesting because, like, it's my dad. And, you know, like, he's obviously, like, I don't think he's a bad dude.
Right.
Of course.
Well,
yeah.
That's also what I liked about it. I hear comparisons to Glengarry Glen Ross, which, you know, if you're going to be compared to someone, it might as well be Mammoth. But it's a little bit different in that the scouts themselves, they aren't in on the con, so it's kind of doubly heartbreaking, you know.
Well, that is the weird thing about, like, kind of those, like, you know, Glengarry Glen Ross is very, it glamorizes, even though, like, those people are all sad in that movie, like, I still feel like it's, like, it's doing its best to try to like glamorize like the ability to kind of be that type of person, which was not necessarily a bad thing, but just not what I was interested in. Yeah.
Tell me about these two lead actors you have in this film. They're sensational. They have great chemistry. How did Pat Healy and Keen Holiday? How did you come about them?
I met Pat, and his name is actually pronounced Kinney. Kinney. He said that it's like Jimi Hendrix, J-I-M-I, etc.
Right.
I met Pat on Undertow, one of David's movies. He played a very small part. He was like a mechanic in this one scene, and I think in the script of the film, like, he has like one line or something, but he just improvised this like amazing little scene, and it was like very funny and kind of like got himself a lot more lines in the movie by virtue of like being able to kind of do that and be like interesting and funny enough to like win all of us over as it being like awesome. So I knew that it was gonna like have a very naturalistic feel in the movie, and that I wanted it to be very like improvisational, and so I like sought him out, and he also kind of I wanted this character to be kind of a Jack Lemmon-esque, you know, like nebbish sort of guy, and so I felt like Pat could kind of like convey that. I think that I saw that in his personality. So I kind of actively went after Pat. Kinney, I literally just met through, you know, we had written a character or whatnot, and we like did some small amount of casting up here in New York City for literally for that role and for two other roles in the movie, and he came in on the first day and was amazing. And
you really feel like you're discovering two actors that you're going to see a lot more of in the future. They're real discoveries in this film. And
oh man, I hope so. I can just say like how much I learned about acting from those guys and like directing the actor and stuff. They're like both really. Can't say enough about how amazing they both are.
How did that idea come? Because we were speaking with Celine earlier in the show, and she was one of the producers at the tail end of this process for you.
Right.
How did that idea come about with having the hidden cameras in the room as they're pitching to all the bands?
It initially kind of came out of me, like when we touched, just a few minutes ago, just saying like that I felt like movies like Gary Glenn Ross were like sort of heroic towards people like this, I had never seen a film that really, like, in my mind, made me feel as much empathy as in real life, I feel like you should feel towards the guys that are on the receiving end of one of those high-pressure sales things, you know? I mean, like, the first time that I ever, I wrote this, the first draft of the script in 2001, it was right around the first time that I ever tried to buy a car, and I remember being on the car lot, like, not thinking about the movie at all, but just, like, being out on the car lot the first day, looking at cars, and somehow, even though I feel like I'm, you know, like, in the film world, I, like, negotiate financial things as, you know, like, as a production manager all the time, and I'm, like, completely comfortable with, like, that type of talk and that type of process, like, I somehow found myself in the situation where I was, like, whisked into a little tiny room and, like, had this guy saying, like, what's it going to take today for you to, you know, like, buy this car, and, you know, like, I almost was just, like, you just kind of get sucked into it by a guy who really knows how to press those high-pressure sales buttons, you know, and I don't know. I wanted to try to, like, capture that, how that feeling was for an audience to, like, empathize with that feeling as much as possible. And when I watched, right around that time, actually, like, right around, like, when was that? I guess it was, like, 2001, was the first time I ever saw Salesman, the Maisels Brothers documentary about door-to-door Bible salesman.
Yeah.
And that was, like, kind of the only other thing I felt like I'd seen that captured that vibe. Really at all.
Oh, you got that vibe down perfectly in this film. It's very tactile. You can get it right away. Now you've started an internet website that for this film, and it appears like a front for the actual company in the film.
Yeah.
Is that right? How crucial does kind of innovative internet marketing in terms of getting the word out on a film? How crucial is that now?
I mean, I suppose that it depends on, like, the level of movie, you know, to be honest. You know, if you're making Transformers, it's not that crucial because, you know, like, you're making Transformers. But with a small film like this, that definitely was, that definitely raised, you know, a more awareness than I ever thought. I literally, I did that with my good friends at Homestar Runner. Who actually helped me design the site. Homestar Runner is another website. I don't know if you're familiar. But they helped me, like, actually make that site. And we just made it. It was mostly we made it because we thought that would be funny. You know what I mean? It was just, like a fun thing to do, you know, to make this kind of poorly. The art of making a poorly made website is almost like an art unto itself. You know, the broken picture links and stuff like that. So it really was like more of a, you know, we were like, that would be a cool thing. But it did take on more of a life of its own than I thought it would. A lot of people have liked it. And actually kind of extrapolating out from that, Magnolia Pictures, when they distributed the movie, you know, they took out like ads and like the back of the Village Voice in New York, like, had like a classified ad for the fake record company, and like we hung flyers up in like certain areas that were those kind of like tear off flyers that would have the phone number like down on the bottom a bunch of times, you know.
I think that's great. I think that's so much fun. So are there filmmakers that you look to that you admire and emulate in terms of a body of work and a strength of career?
I was talking about this the other day, kind of in a broad term with, this is going to be a funny person to pull out of the hat, but people like Alan Parker somehow was able to make a different and new type of movie, like almost every time he made a movie that I don't know. I'm, like, really attracted to people like that. Like, I feel like Michael Winterbottom is doing it right now. Like, every time Winterbottom...
Definitely. Yeah.
Don't you think? I mean, like, every movie he makes, like, is totally not like the last movie. And you're just kind of like, wow.
That's very true.
It's kind of like the anti-style. Like, instead of having, like, a continuous look, like... I'm assuming it's because those guys get bored with the last thing they did or something. You know what I mean? But
I think you're right.
And those are two just fantastic choices that aren't brought up nearly enough. But you know, directors, the greatest directors I think are like our greatest actors. They don't like to repeat themselves. They like to be
committed. Yeah.
They like to investigate different aspects of life and their personalities. So you're absolutely right.
And they mature, too. They grow up. You know, they age. They want to do things differently.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
No, I completely agree. I mean, yeah, and you can just tell in some of those people. It's easier to forgive because it's so hard to make a movie. It, like, takes so long and it costs so much money that, like, you don't get to do them, like, every day. It's not like writing a song or painting a picture or something where you, like, if you make a bad one, it's just, like, lost in the shuffle, you know. But it's like,
yeah,
it's like, if you know, I can't say that I like every Alan Parker movie, but I forgive him the experiments that he tried that were obviously like him trying something new to keep himself going, you know. I think that there's something real noble about that that's really cool, you know.
Absolutely. How does it feel to have a film that is opening to such rave reviews and that people across the country are just eating up? I mean, it released last weekend, didn't it, in limited release?
Great, it did, yeah. That's correct, yeah.
How satisfying does that feel that you're at the end of this road and people are appreciating what you've done?
It's very kind of out of body and crazy. That's very flattering, you know, most definitely. I was saying to a friend of mine last weekend, it was like, you know, the few things that I did look at, it's very much like, wow, that's nice. I bet the director of that movie felt, like, nice after he read that, you know. Like, I don't, like, feel connected to it, really. So it's very flattering.
It is kind of difficult to actually experience, you know, to feel like you're actively experiencing this kind of success, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm trying to not, you know, like, I'm sort of just trying to, like roll with whatever it is, I guess, and right now, like, hopefully, like, I'm sort of very actively trying to, like, start actually with the people of Plum, who you talked to earlier today.
Yeah.
Doing some new stuff and kind of keep going forward and
so tell me.
I've been with the project a long time at this point, you know, so, although it's, like, introduced to everyone now, this has been most of what I've been thinking about since 2004.
Right. So tell me about this next project. Where are you at right now with this project?
Well, we have a script, and we have some of the cast in place, and some of the main cast in place, and we have some of the money in place, I think. And so it's just a matter of you know, schedules and working out things like that, basically, at this point, to see, you know, when it will happen. But it seems like it's going forward, and I'm pretty excited. So.
What kind of themes are you dealing with in this one?
I would say it's not 100% far away from what the last thing was, and that the plot of the new movie is about a guy who moves to. It's much more like a dark comedy than the other movie, but the idea would be that it's kind of about a guy who moves to a small southern town and wants to, and he's a little like off, a little bit like odd, and wants to be sort of a bigger fish in the pond, and decides to run for county commissioner, which isn't even like a, I don't know if you know, but it's like not a paid position at all, you know, it's just like this, like, you know, thing in local politics, but he decides that will, like, get him noticed or whatnot. So, like, it's, I guess it's kind of about, you know, like, how do you make yourself feel, like, valid and powerful in some way or something. Yeah. I definitely wanted to have the tone of, I know you guys were just talking to Howard Shore, I was listening to it, which is, I mean, you guys must be psyched. That's totally amazing.
We're psyched to talk to you. I love your
voice. One of the best shows we've ever done. This is incredible. We've talked to three distinct voices. I can't describe my feeling right now.
Absolutely.
So. I would be really psyched. I mean, Howard Shore is so amazing. But when he brought up After Hours, it's like, not quite After Hours, but the film after that, The King of Comedy.
Oh yeah.
I really love that movie, and I feel like that's definitely kind of like the wheelhouse of like the way I want the comedy to feel for this new movie and stuff.
But. Oh,
you can bring that feeling back. I'm behind you 100%.
Yeah, I don't know if that's possible. I mean, you know, like,
it's
that's possible. My darndest, you know.
Well, is Great World of Sound opening up wider in the coming weeks? What's going to happen with that?
It is. It opens next weekend in LA, and then after Los Angeles, and it's opening at the Landmark in Los Angeles on the 28th, and then after that, it's opening wider to about, right now, I think it's about 15 other cities, and
oh, okay,
we'll
cool.
See how it goes from there. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So check it out.
Well, Craig, thank you so much,
thank
and
you.
Please keep in touch with us. We'd love to have you on any time in the future. About your next project. We really appreciate you being with us tonight.
Yes, thank
oh, well,
you.
Thank you guys a lot, too, man. I like your show.
Thank you so much. It's great to have a fan. Thank you so much. Bye-bye, Craig.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All righty. That is Craig Zobel, writer, director, and producer of Great World of Sound. Great movie, actually. It was the last film I saw, I think, at the
circuit. It just sounds fascinating. I can't wait to see it.
It is.
Very engrossing.
I really appreciate movies, like I said, with Cronenberg and with this one, too, that I haven't seen before.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
That I don't know where they're going with it, and there's such, there are great new talents in this film, Great World of Sound. Those two leads. You
and,
know
and
you're going
to
see a lot
more. He has a rich
more.
Background, the David Gordon Green background. I mean, that's... He's got, I mean, it's a very good, that's a very great launching pad
yeah.
to have, those three films.
Yeah, fantastic movie. And he was talking about the dark comedies, and certainly King of Comedy is as dark a comedy as
yeah, you can't get much better than that. That's a good one. That's the one to start with, wow.
Yeah, that's really something to look to emulate there. But, you know, I think those are coming back in fashion.
I think you're right. I think they go through periods, you know, where they try, they attempt, but I do think those are coming back. I think you're absolutely right.
Well, those awkward, this awkward silences and the uncomfortable comedy where you don't know whether to laugh or not. You know, and it's like the Ricky Gervais show Extras was.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That you couldn't pick a better show to.
Well, yeah, because Extras, I think, took a big cue from the king of that kind of comedy, which is Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And you either get it or you don't. And I know some people that just absolutely don't get Curb.
And when you get it, it's very painful.
I am rolling on the floor.
Oh, it's funny, but you know, it's. Some of those episodes, especially the first season, oh my God!
That episode, The Doll, is just...
Oh, I know! Oh
my God!
It's
one of the most classic half hours on television ever. So that comes on again tonight, so we'll be watching that tonight.
Yes.
But it's been a great show. Let me tell everyone what's coming on Wednesday night's show. I should have announced this at the top of the show, but... Wednesday evening, we have Andy Fickman, who is the director of the new film starring The Rock called The Game Plan. So we're actually going to be talking about a family movie on Wednesday.
So I have to be on my best behavior.
Yes. But then we're going to Kelly Masterson, and he is the screenwriter of a film called Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
The new Sidney Lumet film.
Absolutely.
So I can sort of loosen up.
Yeah, that premiered at Toronto Film Festival, I believe. And the notices are just coming back on it. I just read an Entertainment Weekly write-up on.
Yeah, no, it's getting great ones.
They said that, you know, Sidney Lumet, 83 years old, he directs with as much energy and vigor and enthusiasm as someone half his age in this film. They said it's a real... return of Lumet,
yeah, and
the kind of character work he does best.
And this is kind of very interesting. It's like you have Lumet, De Palma, Coppola, Nichols, all these great icons of the 70s have new films.
I felt that way about Closer, when I saw Closer.
Yeah, I mean, but you have all these guys at the same time, and Coppola and De Palma really going back to their roots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very fascinating fall. I mean, and you have these newer guys making films that... bring to mind the great message and issues movies of the 70s, like Michael Clayton or Reservation Road or Rendition, or even Nichols doing the alternate message movie, Charlie Wilson's War.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fascinating season.
You know, there's a lot, yeah, and usually fall is the time of the year when I'm most excited about
it. I think, yeah, you can't help it.
You can't beat this fall.
I haven't seen anything like this in years.
The return of our masters. And it's so encouraging in theaters where, you know, out of 18 screens, 10 of them are dedicated to Transformers or something, which there's definitely a place for that.
There's a place for that. I don't know if you need 10 screens, though, but you're right. It's like 5 or 6 screens, you know, on opening day. And while that's good in one sense for the consumer, you don't have to worry about it selling out, it's crowding out a film like could easily go to Grace Is Gone.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it feels like these masters that we've revered for so many years, they're sensing some kind of artistic renaissance, or they're propelling that themselves, you know.
Well, I think they still have something to say, which is very encouraging.
Yeah, and Coppola seems completely refreshed.
It seems that way, just from interviews.
Yeah, he feels like a student again. And his next movie is, I think it's called Tetro?
That's right. That's
Matt Dillon.
That's right, yeah.
Signed on to be in that one, and they have a history together through Rumblefish and...
The Outsiders, so...
The Outsiders, right.
What you know, it's really interesting about Coppola, though. Is his last film The Rainmaker that he directed?
Yes.
And that's not a bad, actually, of the Grissom films, books to come to screen, it's actually much better than it has any right to be.
Well, yeah, and he wanted to, I remember reading the article on that, he wanted to know what it's like to direct a famous book, or a film version of a famous author's work. So he read The Rainmaker on a plane, and by the time he got off that plane, he had already signed the deal to make
it. And he did a wonderful job with it. It's a very underappreciated movie.
It is the best of the Grisham movies, I believe.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Because what is Coppola's strength? I mean, you can talk about his visual audacity and that kind of thing, but look at what makes The Godfather so classic. It is classic storytelling sense.
Mm-hmm.
The man can tell a story.
Oh, he can.
And that was the strength of The Rainmaker.
Absolutely.
It was a great story, just fantastically told. And so I'm so excited about Copeland.
Yeah, it's just great to see him back doing something because, I mean, he pulls the strings. I mean, for Sophia and for Spike Jonze, he's been, and for Roman, you know, his hands and everything, but it's just nice to actually see him behind the camera once again.
Yeah, I agree. And have you seen the trailer for that one?
No, I have not seen the trailer for this one, so I am eager, very eager to see.
There's a teaser up for it, and of course it looks visual, and it's kind of opaque. You don't necessarily get a sense of what the movie is. I mean, you can look it up and find out what it's about.
Right.
You know, but it looks very intriguing.
Well, that will do it for me. I'm there.
Yeah, that's what a trailer should do. It should not give away everything. It should just...
It does seem, though. You know, it's really funny. Some of the films you go see, and it is amazing after you're done watching, you're like, wow, the trailer really gave everything away.
That's what Chris felt about a movie that just came out recently. No, it didn't come out. That's how he felt about the trailer for The Bucket List. He felt, well, I don't have to see it now.
He might be right. It does feel that way with some of these trailers. You're just like, wow. I saw one for a movie I am looking forward to, Reservation Road, but it does look like the whole movie has been given to me.
Right. Now, which one is that one?
That's Joaquin Phoenix. I want to see Joaquin Phoenix. And I got to say, it looks, you know, I'm not going to say what it's about, but it's very reminiscent of a movie that came out a couple years ago, like the same kind of structure, the same, The House of Sand and Fog.
Oh.
And it has that kind of, it looks like a very tragic story, but it's very engrossing. But I got to warn you, the trailer does look like it gives away a good chunk of the movie.
Yeah, I think Joaquin Phoenix is in like every fifth or sixth movie made now.
Yeah, he is, but I got to say, he's in two that look really good. We Own the Night and Reservation Road. So
absolutely, and we have, I called into one of the Blog Talk Radio shows earlier this week, and she loves us. She's a huge fan of our show, and she was really interested to know what we felt about We Own the Night. So I guess on someone's list, it's right at the top of movies that
we're
looking forward to.
Yeah, it's James Gray, and I think he has a working history with Joaquin Phoenix, so it should be. It's got Mark Wahlberg, it's Robert Duvall. It looks really good.
Yeah, I remember reading reviews from screenings of that, and they say that it's just a. It's a real dynamic, it's sexy, it's violent, it's emotional, you know, it's everything you go to the movies for.
Wow, okay, it's all that, okay.
Yeah, well, Eva Mendez is in it too, and apparently, you know, there's some steam in the film.
Right.
But James Gray, his film The Yards.
That's the one I was thinking of, and I was really, that's a very well done film.
That's considered a great, underrated movie.
It is.
It didn't really get its due.
No, it was very funny. It's the same. It came out a couple weeks after The Wave of the Gun, and it marked this. I would have to say, if it's possible for James Caan to have a comeback, he gives these two back-to-back performances that really recall Thief, The Godfather, The Gambler. I mean, all the stuff that made him so good.
Yeah.
And he is a dynamo in that film, both of those films. I mean,
he's a great presence. He still is. We were watching, Tiffany and I were watching Eraser.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to lie. It's one of the last of the decent Schwarzenegger films.
Who directed that? What was the...
Oh, God, I don't know off the top of my head.
I couldn't think of it either, but I was just watching Schwarzenegger and James Caan together, and I was thinking to myself, what a wild time they must have had together.
Yeah.
Because the two of them are wild men, apparently.
Oh, yeah, I don't doubt that.
So that must have been kind of a rowdy experience.
I think that was the last thing I saw Schwarzenegger in that I thought he was, you know, showed some, that he was still having fun with the movies.
Yeah. You think we'll see him get back into cinema again? And do you think, given his experience as a leader in government, that we'll be able to accept him as readily as we did before?
I think so. It depends what happens. I'm surprised. I'm still amazed at what he was able to do to get reelected. I still find that because there was talk that he was a lame duck, that he wasn't going to get reelected, and he turned his fortunes around very quickly.
Yeah.
Do I think it depends what he can do, what roles. I mean, you know, there are people that want him to do Terminator 4, and they're still talking about True Lies too. Not that I think Cameron is, I think he's abandoned that, but I think he does his best work with James Cameron.
I think anybody does.
Yeah, but
I think you look,
really,
you look at most people James Cameron's worked with, and you pretty much agree their best work was with him.
Yeah, I think, but I think with Schwarzenegger, it's really, I don't think he feels comfortable with anyone else. And just given the work after what he did with Cameron, I think he really, they have, I think, an understanding of each other. I don't know what Schwarzenegger's going to do. I mean, I think, you know, if anything can happen with him. He
can
do, if he says he's going to do something, he's going
to
do it.
Well, he wants to run for president, I think.
They have to make an amendment for that.
Yeah, and he wants to do that. And so you just made the statement, whatever he wants to do, he could do.
Well, let's put it like this. If the Republicans don't get in office,
right,
trust me, they're all going to be making sure that amendment gets passed for 2012.
And he is a pretty left-leaning Republican.
Yes, he is.
I think he's a natural-born leader. I think he is the epitome of an American success story.
No, I agree with that.
And a very strong character, and I'm sure that people overseas, you know, world leaders, it's an interesting question how they would respond to him.
Would they, Jamie, any different than how they responded to Reagan? Everyone laughed when Reagan went into politics.
Yeah, but, I mean, Reagan did a movie with a monkey.
Well, Schwarzenegger did a movie with Jake Lloyd. Okay, never mind.
Reagan was not...
He was never, except for King's Row, he was never considered a great actor.
Yeah.
King's Row was
neither,
really...
Neither Schwarzenegger, but Schwarzenegger is a movie star.
Is a blockbuster. He is a household name.
Absolutely. So would that command respect?
I don't know. You know, it's... That's one of those great what-ifs. I don't think it matters. A lot of factors will go into if that happens, which I would most certainly think it. There's a huge possibility it will, but that's a great what if. You know, what will world leaders think?
If nothing else, there's a sense of familiarity there that I don't think would necessarily be a negative.
Not in the way things have gone the last 8 years. I don't think so. I think people would welcome it. Believe it or not, I really think they would. And just looking, like you said, his left leaning policies in California have. I mean, Democrats like him in California, I think all over the country, but especially in California, they actually are really surprised. I think they're surprised that they like him.
Yeah. It's an amazing how we're a movie show, and for the first time we've gotten off on politics.
Well, no, I think it's very important because we're both very well-rounded individuals. So
absolutely. There's more to us than movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, back to movies.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's go back.
Oliver Stone has cast Bruce Willis in the lead of Pinkville. Which is great. Speaking about political-themed movies, you know, it's his film about the My Lai Massacre. And Bruce Willis in an Oliver Stone film. Doesn't that just make you salivate?
I think it's been waiting to happen for a while. I think it will be a good contrast for both of them to work together. I think it'll bring out a lot of good stuff for the screen. I think it'll be good for Oliver Stone because he's obviously going to address Iraq by making this movie.
A direct parallel, yeah. Mm-hmm. How little we've learned in that interim.
Yes.
Is what statement he is going to make, I'm sure. But, you know, Bruce Willis is one of our great movie stars, and he really is. Just a fantastic presence. But people forget how great of an actor he is. You know,
they forget a lot. I mean,
when he gets a juicy, really dynamic role with a great director... You know, not someone that's, you know, green or just starting out or is good at making, you know, certain genre pictures.
Yeah, but he was great in 12 Monkeys.
Well, and Oliver Stone will pull. You talk about Cameron bringing out the best in people. Oliver Stone, hands down, he pulls out one fantastic performance after another.
Well, he'll definitely do that with Willis.
And he'll literally beat it out of you.
He may beat out of that. Well, I would love to be a fly on the wall during the making of that.
Well, you hear these stories of Oliver Stone as a director and how he'll do anything it takes to get that get that emotion going. And it can be very combative.
Yes.
That experience. But that's what makes a great director.
Yeah, right? I mean, but that combative, that thing, that's what makes a great movie. If the, you know, what is it they say? If the movie is run, goes along very smoothly,
yeah,
chances are it's a very bland movie.
Yeah.
So you want those stories. You want it to be like, well, I mean, you don't want it to be like, okay, the, you know, the thing went over budget like $200 million or something. But no, you want it, there needs to be, you know, a lot of tension on the set, I think, for it to be really good.
Yeah. Do you get a sense, though, that the war film, you know, they were very much in vogue in the, oh, I don't know, the mid-late 80s on. Do you get a sense, though, that since Saving Private Ryan, people have pretty much thought, why bother? I mean, I can't portray the actual...
I think it's a number of factors. I think Saving Private Ryan is the bookend onto a celebration in the mid-90s of the Greatest Generation with the Stephen Ambrose and Tom Brokaw books.
Yeah.
And I think, and that's very important. But it's not so much that. I think it's what we've talked about a number of times. It's just hard to release... It's even though it does seem like the country is somewhat it is hard to believe that we are involved in two wars right now. It is hard to release a war film in a time of war.
Yeah.
And especially an unpopular war. It was not easy, but during the World War II, they were propaganda films.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked to their advantage. But here, it's very difficult. I don't know how these films are going to do. This is a very sensitive issue. I don't, you know, like, I like Flags of Our Fathers, and a lot of people said it was the Saving Private Ryan clone, and while that's accurate to a certain degree with the Steven Spielberg producer credit on it, it's a very cynical war film. And after watching Letters from Iwo Jima, which in both of these that Paul Haggis had a hand in writing, and then watching In the Valley of Elah, I know where the cynicism comes from Haggis.
Well, I mean, you can look at Clint Eastwood's past couple of movies and see that cynicism as well.
Yeah, it's there, but I think it's also, I think it's really, watching In the Valley of Elah, that's definitely like Haggis. I think it's more Haggis and Eastwood, although I read an interview with Eastwood after Flags of Our Fathers came out, and he had soured on the Iraq War as well. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely that. The war film is a tough sell. If I went to any producer, any studio, and said, "Hey, I want to make a movie about this war, big epic," they're probably not going to. They might wait till after the season, but they may not greenlight it because I just think people. It's just not the time to do it.
Mm. Could be, but it opens up an interesting discussion, which is, what is the creative community is, you know, not just limited to film, but in any form, what is their responsibility to reflect the time we live in right now?
Well, that's a good question, and it's going to take a lot longer than 13 minutes. But no, but if I can, this is something very important, because this is something that I've been thinking about a couple of years. And you're dealing with, let's put an unpopular war. You're dealing with a thing that, as we've talked about, it changes on a daily basis. The narrative changes, and we can't agree, our politicians can't agree on when to get out, or even to get out, it looks like now.
Mm-hmm.
I read a couple weeks ago, Jamie, that we were supposed to be there till 2019.
Yeah. I mean,
2019.
We're still in Germany. We're still...
Yeah.
You know, we're still...
I don't think people realize, and I'm not... Look, this is, I was not for this. There was, you know, there are some things you're for, and it's really funny. We're talking about this, and we have the ultimate statement on war is going to start in a couple minutes on PBS, the Ken Burns documentary.
Right.
Which promises, speaking of Saving Private Ryan, is almost, you could say, the anti-Saving Private Ryan, judging from the reviews I've read.
Well, but this is it. The responsibility, I think, is being met in a way. We talk about Oliver Stone, we talk about this Ken Burns project, by going back to history to look at the lessons that history has to teach us and the parallels it draws to our situation today.
That's
now,
the smartest way to do it.
Do you think that's smart, or do
you
think that's a cop-out?
Yes, I do, because I think it has... it's good that you bring this up because there's a book that's coming out. David, the late David Halverson, his last book is about the Korean conflict.
Mm.
And it's called, I think it's called The Coldest Winter, and it comes out this week. And I've been reading his reviews, and a lot of the mistakes made in that war and a lot of the run-up to that war are he's making parallels to what happened in Iraq. And I think what you're showing, and you show this with Vietnam, is that history has repeated itself. It's the oldest lesson. History just repeats itself. You have the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. You have the weapons of mass destruction claim by the administration this time.
Right.
And it's just, and I do think there, in these books, especially about the older conflicts, we're getting a sense, wow, this is not new. This has happened before. And I think the first thing you ask is, how do we get fooled? Again and again.
Well, that's De Palma's take.
And it's an important take, I think, on his part.
On Redacted. I think that Redacted is just incredibly, whatever you think of the movie, incredibly ballsy, no matter
what. You know, he has gotten the most press he's gotten in a long time, and the film hasn't even come out.
Yeah. But you know going into making something like that, that you're going to get so much opposition, and that's probably what he's counting on too.
He's definitely counting on it. That's his, like, you know, as he's gotten older, and he wants that, and he knows that's what sells tickets, and hopefully that will sell tickets and get people, you know, also raise awareness.
They probably don't even need to do any publicity on that movie. Just leave it to O'Reilly, 3 nights.
Oh, O'Reilly's doing everyone's business for them.
All right, well, honestly, we're not talking about political positions or anything here as much as how Hollywood handles current event issues. It's just a topic we just kind of fell in after a discussion about The Great World of Sound.
No, but it's important because I think Hollywood is trying to figure that out. They tried to figure this. It's very interesting because I think one of the most important points to bring out is the conflict is still going on and they're releasing movies, whereas generally, like with Vietnam, you had to wait a couple of years.
Yeah.
And with the last Gulf War, Three Kings and Courage Under Fire came out long after.
Yeah, you're right. This conflict is defining, for better or worse, it's defining a certain subsect of our generation.
Yes.
Or the generation before ours, you know.
Yes.
It's not going to completely end anytime soon.
No, that's what I. And you also brought up a good point and a very important point just outside of film. Yeah, we're still in Germany. We're still in Japan.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this thing's going to be with us for a while. But I do think we'll have to see. You know, the best thing that we can do, Jamie, is maybe at the end of the year, the beginning of next year, is we can do the reception of these films, the critical audience reception of the films, and I think that's where you start.
It's going to be a very interesting Oscar season.
Yeah.
To see how well these films are embraced, or if they're embraced at all. Anyway, that's it for tonight's show. It's been a really good one.
This has been an awesome show.
We'll be back with you guys Wednesday night with Kelly Masterson, the screenwriter of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and Andy Fickman, the director of the new film starring The Rock called The Game Plan. Until then, we'll see you guys next time.
All right, good night, everyone. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.